You are listening to Microchurches, a podcast for missionaries and leaders living out their God-given calling through this small expression of the church. This podcast is meant to encourage, equip, and contribute to the overall discussion of this smaller way. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy. You're listening to Microchurches, a podcast for people brave enough to be small. This is your host, Tommy Wilkerson, and in this season and series, we are talking to microchurch and network leaders from around the U.S. and around the world, figuring out what they're learning as they're going about microchurch life and equipping other microchurch leaders. And so this episode, I'm super excited because I'm joined by Joshua Benedum, currently of Dwell out in Ohio, and Josh, thank you so much for being part of this podcast.
Yeah, man, it's been a blast hanging out with you. I'm excited.
So, Josh has been on. So, depending on the time of this release and the order in which we release some of these episodes, you're going to hear a lot of Josh in this season. He's been on a few of our conversations around some of these things. And part of that is because Dwell is just such an incredible community that has been around for a long period of time. So sometimes people look to the underground and see us as kind of forerunners or people who are just a little bit further up the road from maybe what they're currently doing. And that's always an honor. And we don't take that lightly. But really for us, the people who are further up from us, the people that we look to and are learning a lot from would be Dwell out in Ohio. And I mean, so it's been really cool to kind of learn from them, observe their journey, the way that they think about some of these things. And just the conversations that I've had with Josh have been so enriching for me that I just feel like to the extent that we can give that away to the listener and to the audience for them to also learn from people who are further up the road. I just think that'd be a tremendous gift. And so, Josh, I really do and am grateful for you. And so maybe, you know, with that, maybe a good as place of any to start is by starting with Dwell. And I mean, I know there's a long history there. And so we don't have to get into everything, but I mean, the story of Dwell, the history of Dwell as in a sense, and kind of catch the listener up to what is this community that you've had.
Yeah, totally. Well, so Dwell was originally called Xenos Christian Fellowship, spelled X-E-N-O-S. And it wasn't originally called Xenos Christian Fellowship. It was actually originally, its absolute origin point was actually a Jesus Movement era gathering house church of sorts called the Fish House, which began in 1969 on Ohio State's campus. And you know, it's always interesting, I think, being a part of a movement, because we're so prone sometimes to see ourselves as a part of something that is just happening where we are, right? Like, oh, this is what God's doing in Tampa. This is what God's doing in California and Costa Mesa and Columbus, whatever. But it's one thing that's really interesting is you zoom out and look at some of the things that God has done in different places. It often seems like what God is doing in one location often has cultural ripples. And I think that what happened in Columbus in 1969 is in many ways similar. It's not really just about Dwell. In fact, Vineyard, the largest Vineyard church in the country also began during that same period in Columbus. And that was also concurrent with everything that was happening during, you know, the so-called Jesus Revolution, the Jesus Movement happening out in California. And so it was really all a part of this larger movement of the Holy Spirit that was way bigger than our church, way bigger than Columbus. And in many ways, the Fish House, which later named itself Xenos as it grew into this network of house churches, it was really a part of that much larger movement of God during the late 60s, 1970s. And for people who aren't familiar, the Jesus Movement, there's actually that new movie that's out called The Jesus Revolution, about Greg Laurie, Chuck Smith, Lonnie Frisbee, and some of those guys, that they were kind of the, ground zero in many ways for that movement in America. But it was really this massive movement of people who were hippies. They'd come out of the hippie movement. They'd been, you know, they tried every element of Eastern religion. They'd tried drugs, and they kind of came out of that and came to faith in Jesus. And as they came to faith in Jesus, they realized that they didn't fit in the traditional model of church. And so they began to go back to the New Testament and to explore Just what was the early church really like? And what are the non-essential things that have been added over time? What does it look like for this generation to be the church in a way that draws its inspiration from the book of Acts and not necessarily just sort of the denominationalism that they've been handed through their parents, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's really the origin point of Dwell. You know, the church has changed, evolved, developed a lot over the course of years. And I'm only 35, so I was not there in 1969. I'm a second generation leader in this movement. But that's really where the church came from. It grew rapidly from this sort of student-led house church movement, mostly people from non-Christian backgrounds, a lot of people coming out of drug and hippie backgrounds who came to Christ and really just saw their lives radically changed. And so, you know, we actually didn't own any buildings at all until the 90s. Mm. Until that point, whenever there were larger gatherings, we called them central teachings, where the house churches would come together. Those would be held in like warehouse spaces that we would rent on a short-term basis, sometimes without air conditioning or anything else like that. And so it wasn't really until the 90s that we became kind of more of a brick and mortar. We had a brick and mortar element to us. We began to own buildings, opened up a school during that time. But the church has never really lost that sort of grassroots house church, personal discipleship basis. That's the core ethos of the church. It's where it came from. And in many ways, that's exactly what the church still is today.
Yeah. I think what I've always appreciated about you all is, or one thing I've appreciated about you all as I've gotten the chance to know you, is there is a strong sense of history and of documenting the history. And like, even so, yeah, for you being 35, not necessarily having been first generation of the movement, you still know the history and it lives in you. And so, I mean, there's so much to unpack even in that. So, I mean, we were talking about the fact that, yeah, you guys have been around since 1969, and it really wasn't until COVID that you guys started really considering your online presence. Like, because yeah, right. You're like, oh, wait, we're actually, because you're not just a small network of, you know, five house churches or something like that, which is beautiful in its own right. You guys are, your structure is insane. Like, you have house churches, spheres, like, I mean, break that down for the listener real quick, like how Dwell operates and is structured, and even what you mean by like central teaching and some of that stuff.
Yeah, well, and I always make this qualification that, you know, that again, what we are now is the product of development and of long-term development that fits our size and the needs of the church. And I think that's true. As I've coached and worked with people doing microchurch and house church work across the country and in different countries, I think one of the temptations, and this is probably true in any corner of the church world, but there's always this temptation to want to be like, oh, what do you guys do? Maybe we could do that too, you know? And while I do think that there's a lot of value in learning about structures and methods, the other organizations, other churches have, a lot of times the value, if you're in a completely different place, is mostly inspirational, right? It's to get you thinking more critically about your own context and to get you thinking about, you know, what is God doing here? Who are we? Getting you to go back to the Bible and think about like what makes sense for us to do at this time and how can we best reflect in our environment, just that spirit of the early church, you know? And so, you know, for us, yeah, I mean, as house churches multiplied and grew, there was this eventual sense that if we are going to stay one church, if we are going to remain, you know, one body of believers under a board of elders, then we really needed to have sort of like broken down more local pastoral structures, right? For placing and kind of understanding, you know, what was going on with different groups. And I think that's really the challenge of a scaled out house church movement, or maybe even a scaled out micro church movement, is there's all these questions that come up when you're thinking about that independence, autonomy, authority relationships, spiritual authority. What's that look like in a context where you're equipping and raising up people to not just run small group discussions, but to really be lay pastors, to lead house churches, right? But still in the context of a larger network, you know? And so for us, one of those solutions was to really use our pooled resources to employ pastors and, we call them coaches, organizers, people that can oversee, equip, and encourage families of house churches. And so the word that we use for that is a sphere, which all that really means is, like, you know, if you're trying to chart, you know, okay, who's who, and you're drawing up all these house churches, it just means you draw a circle around some and say, okay, all of these are kind of related. They all came from the same place, and therefore that's a sphere. It's a circle. It's a grouping of house churches. And so we raised up, you know, pastors that we sometimes call sphere leaders or coaches that usually have some kind of organic connection to that family of house churches. Maybe they're the ones that were apostolically involved in planting many of those house churches, or something like that. And so really to be a pastor in our network, primarily more than anything else, means that you are a pastor, a resource, an equipper, an encourager to the lay leaders, the people that facilitate these fairly autonomous house churches that are sprinkled throughout a part of the city. Mm. And so that's a big part of our leadership structure. Now those sphere leaders or those coaches operate under the authority of a board of elders. We are ultimately an elder-led church. We believe that's biblical. That's the leadership paradigm we see in the New Testament. And so we do have a flat leadership structure at the top, where we have a plurality of elders who ultimately oversee the church. But I guess in terms of involvement in an individual home church, or if you were leading a house church that was a part of one of these spheres or one of these networks, your main point of contact would be a pastor, or maybe a team of pastors that is primarily responsible to that network of house churches. Mm. And so that's the structure that we use. It's really not that dissimilar if you study some of the DMM disciple making movement stuff that's happening in missions. In a lot of ways, without ever having studied those models, we operate fairly similar to the way that a lot of house church and just church networks in the majority world operate. If you study the house church movement in China, if you study what's happening in parts of West Africa. In a lot of ways, whenever we connect with those groups, we usually feel like, okay, we're actually doing something pretty similar. Find that we have a lot in common with those groups and with those churches, just in terms of how we operate.
Yeah. So cool. And then, I mean, so you have this, group of pastors that kind of oversee these spheres, but then you do have these maybe two, which I think is fascinating about your story. I mean, a whole other conversation for another day is you were started by these two guys who kind of co-planted, co-led together, and then they both kind of transitioned out of their roles at the same time. And instead of like converting to a single leader, they kept it co-leadership. And so there's two more guys who are kind of maybe a more executive role within the community. And so just explain that. Like, okay, so you have this flat team of elders and pastors who oversee the lay leaders. And then what's the role of those two guys? Do they oversee the pastors, or are they just more executive function type thing?
Yeah, so there are, on our elder team, we have two senior elders. We call them, you could call them senior pastors, but basically the only unique function of their role is that they set the agenda for the elders meetings. There's a few unique responsibilities they have. They set the agenda for the elders meetings. They also attend what we call our management team meetings, which are our management team meetings is where our administrative or executive branch leaders, not executive branch, I guess, I don't know what the right term for it is, but I guess our administrative leadership meets with the senior elders, and they bring back sort of core logistical decisions that require a bigger picture perspective back to the elders. And so they sort of act as the main bridge between some of the administrative functions of the church and the spiritual decision-making of the church. And they set the agenda for our elders meetings. They also do our annual reviews for all of the elders and also the pastors. But then we also in turn conduct their annual reviews. And so there is a mutual accountability. They don't have a weighted vote or anything like that. You know, so we're making decisions on the elder board. It's not like they, I think they have a lot of influence, but they don't have any kind of unique say, I guess you could say, in that context. And so that's the way that we've organized it. And again, it's really just a reflection of what we developed over the course of time. Because like you said, we had two primary founding pastors, those guys always emphasized the plurality of leadership at pretty much every level. And so house churches have a plurality of leadership. Pretty much, we don't really endorse house churches that have less than four leaders. Mm. And we, you know, even on the pastoral level, you know, we always have team leadership at every single place, and we think that's important for accountability, and not just accountability, but even. I don't know, just wisdom, right? You know, and an abundance of counselors, there's victory. And so that's another core aspect, I think, of the ethos that God's given us.
So cool. So, I mean, you're talking about house churches a little bit. And for you, I mean, the question is how you guys define or go about defining house churches and how they're started in your network. I mean, some of what we're talking about here in terms of leadership and, I know that you guys have also produced a wealth of resources for your leaders around best practices for some of these house churches. Part of what we're getting into is like lessons and things that you've learned along the way. But I just think Dwell is such a fascinating community. Trying to get underneath the hood a little bit and paint the picture for the listener, that the house church and what you guys are talking about when you say house church, I mean, yeah, I guess help the audience kind of enter into what you mean when you say house church.
Yeah. So the way that I've always found the most useful for explaining what a house church is explaining what it's not, right? And so a house church is not a small group. It's not the same thing. I think, you know, sometimes I'll interact with pastors and other networks, and they'll say, "Oh yeah, we do what you guys do." But then when you really drill into it, they don't. And I would say that the key distinguishing features of a house church have to do with authentic leadership, authentic anointed leadership, and then also with the expectation that what happens in the house church is fully the church, right? So like when you think of like what should happen in the church, like what is, I mean, I love what one thing I love from your guys' literature is the whole notion of the ecclesial minimum. And I really agree with that. I think the ecclesial minimum is dead on. I think that we're in lockstep on that point. However, there are other things, you know, there's the minimum of what needs to be there for a church to exist, which is very little. However, there's also things that, as we read the New Testament, there's things that the church ought to do as well, right? There's things that you can still be the church and not do those things, but the church should do these things. And so, you know, examples of that would be, I would say things like baptizing its members, evangelism, discipling one another, primarily being responsible for the development of new believers, right? Teaching the word, like those are things that. In your prevailing model church, those are centralized elements. We decentralize those things. We think that those things, you know, our centralized structures should exist to make sure that those things can happen as well as they possibly can on the micro level, on the house church level. And so much of our pastoral and leadership energy goes into things like trying to make sure that that our lay leaders, our house church leaders, are well trained theologically and competent in teaching and preaching the word, right? Mm. And so it's not that we don't do centralized preaching, we do. It's not that we don't do centralized equipping, we do. But we view it as almost facilitating or subsidiary. It's there to support what's happening in the house churches. And so house churches, it's just like I said, they are in many ways, they are autonomous church environments. They run their own events. They organize discipling their members. They lead people to Christ and they baptize those people. They do life together. They preach the word. And so anything and everything that you can imagine that happens in the church happens in the house church. And so in many ways, the house church is actually a fairly sophisticated environment. Mm. And you know, a lot of, if you interact with people who are critical of the house church model, and I was actually just talking to a guy the other day, who's a denominational leader, and he was telling me some of his gripes with house churches, and I think he's right. I mean, one thing that I'll always say is that, you know, I believe in the house church model because I think that it is faithful to the biblical example, and I think it's one of the best wineskins, one of the best containers, so to speak, for living out the one another passages, you know, the things that Jesus and Paul and John tell us ought to illustrate Christian community, right? Like I don't see the large scale unit being ideal for that. I think it's best in the world of the small. I know that you guys would agree. However, every church model has its problems. And one common critique of house churches is that they're shallow, right? Is that they're often not that qualitative because they don't have well-trained leadership. They're not well-resourced. And so there's all these limitations to being in a house church, things that larger churches can do better. And so I think what we have tried to do as God has grown our movement is find ways to how can we keep the strengths of the authentic, small, biblical environment that is the house church, while then minimizing some of its weaknesses with the larger apparatus of the structure of our church that exists through our pooled resources, right?
Right.
And that is actually something that I think that, you know, there's a lot of things that we don't do well. I was just laughing the other day about how the fact that we're just not that good at events, large events, you know, we're just not that slick.
Neither are we.
It's caused us problems, because people expect churches to be slick and to be well presented and easy to communicate with, and so some of those clunky aspects of the larger manifestation of our church have caused misunderstanding and difficulty throughout time. But one of the things that I think that we do really, really well is our house churches are not shallow. So that criticism of house churches, of them being, you know, maybe like, oh yeah, it's a great technique for going a mile wide and an inch deep. That's something you might hear sometimes. I think by God's grace, we're a mile wide and we're a mile deep. I think our house churches are highly sophisticated. And a lot of that comes down to the development and training of our house church leaders.
Yeah. And you guys have like a wealth of, I mean, I think there's a lot of things that a network like this necessitates. But one of those things I do think is commitment. And you got, your people are committed. So, I mean, I just remember you talking in conversations that we've had that your house churches, I mean, you're practicing church discipline at the house church level. If I remember correctly, you have your central teaching gatherings, but you have your house churches. These house churches, it's not mandated, it's not forced, but it's best practices to have some sort of like what guy accountability group, female accountability group. So they've got that going on top of their regular house church meetings. Central teachings are a bit more optional, but they can opt into those. And I feel like there's like another thing, like one-on-ones, or there's like another kind of meeting that is just a little bit recommended for your house churches too, right?
Right. I mean, you said it well. I think that we don't have, it's not that there's like rules, but we actually don't have any formal membership. So there's no rules for membership. It's not like, oh, you're a member if you do all these things or something like that. But we do have a culture of high involvement, and part of that has to do with the fact that the house churches are organic communities. Mm. They're not a bunch of random people from different walks of life that have been gathered up because they filled out a form that said they're mutually interested in being a part of a house church. They're organic communities in the sense that they're usually founded off relational networks. It's, you know, if you go back, it's, you know, this guy came to Christ when he was in high school. He brought a couple of his buddies to Christ. They ended up joining this group and they won some friends to Christ. A few of them got married. At some point that group grew and they kind of did a plant and a new group was created. But then, you know, they brought out some more friends and their wives brought out some friends. And now you've got this house church and people they've known each other for their friends, their family. They've known each other for 9 years, you know? And so there's an element where, because they're organic communities, it's not like people are signing up for some sort of crazy program which demands, you know, four nights a week or something like that. It's more so, the healthiest way to view it would be actually you have these organic relational communities of people who are truly doing life together, and they provide many different opportunities for connection and for spiritual growth. Mm. So for instance, the main event for any house church is the house church meeting. And so a house church meeting is characterized by times of fellowship before the meeting and after the meeting. The meeting itself is usually a discussion oriented Bible study that sort of moves between what some people would probably think of as preaching, where there's more of like an instructive element to it, but then these spaces created for meaningful interaction and discussion with the people that are there. And then hanging out, you know, late into the evening. And so that's really the main event for any house church. But like you said, the vast majority of house churches also do weekly men's and women's groups. And not everybody from the house church will attend those, but a lot of people will. And again, it's because they want to, you know, it's hope, you know, when you get a situation where people go because they don't want to, that's usually a fairly unhealthy and negative situation. So it's like, you know, people want to grow. They want to do that kind of deeper discussion, Bible study in that environment, but they also want to have that time with, you know, people of the same gender. But, you know, then also throughout the week, most people in a given house church are also meeting up in discipling relationships, meaning that they're meeting one-on-one, one-on-two, in rare cases, two-on-two or one-on-three. And these are kind of like Paul and Timothy. The best way that I like to explain discipling relationships is by looking at Paul, Timothy, and Barnabas, where you've got, you know, I would say that all three of those men and their relationships are types of discipleship relationships. And so Paul and Timothy is kind of the mentoring type relationship, which a lot of people think of when they think of personal disciple making. It's Paul to Timothy, it's Jesus to the disciples. It's a much more, you've got the more experienced believer teaching the younger believer. And so sometimes it looks like that. Other times it's more of a Paul and Barnabas type relationship, where you've got, you know, people who are peers that have these sort of this spiritual friendship based around meeting weekly or every other week together, studying the Bible, and then also trying to do ministry together, trying to get out there and win their neighbors and, you know, building a partnership of sorts, just like Paul and Barnabas had. And so we also teach and encourage people to engage on that level with each other as well.
Mm. So cool.
And yeah, you know, and it's people. That is a question that we get sometimes. I think a lot of American churches will kind of just sit there flabbergasted and be like, how do you get your people to do all that? You know? Yeah. And the answer to that question is again, it has a lot to do with the fact that it's organic. Mm. It's not programmatic. You know, it's people come into these communities. You know, the typical entry point into our church is through the house church. It's not through the larger meetings.
Yeah.
Someone might invite their neighbor or their coworker or their friend from school, and that's how they become a part, or they start, you know, interfacing with the house church. And so it's really one of those things where it's like, yeah, you're attending this house church, and you know, it turns out the guys hang out on Friday nights too. And you're like, I love these people. I'm, you know, I'm learning about God and I want to go to the Friday night thing, you know? And so And so it's really a natural interwovenness that occurs when you've got really authentic community happening. And so it's a culture, it's an ethos that's been built over time. And it's not for everybody. I think that's something else that I'd say. I think that a lot of, you know, I think it's important for people who want to do something like what we do to try to implement it according to their, you know, to not be rigid in the way that they implement it. I think that, you know, for instance, this is just a simple example, but a lot of our groups that are mostly demographically young families, they don't do an every week men's and women's group because it's too hard for both for the couple to get babysitters, you know, both nights of the week and all that kind of stuff. And so they'll often do like an every other week thing, guys and girls switching off. And, you know, sometimes different discipleship, ways of organizing discipleship make more sense depending on life stage, depending on, you know, people's availability and time. And so it shouldn't be a rigid thing. And, you know, and something that we tell people pretty freely when they come around is that we're not a church for everyone. Mm. We really believe in what we do. We feel like it's what God gave us to do, and we're going to keep doing it, unapologetically. But it's also not necessarily for everyone. And what we mean by that is that people's life circumstances are very different. One of the unique things about living in America as a believer is that there's just many authentic expressions of the church. And so for people, I don't think it's, you know, if people are part of something like what we do and they're like, you know, this is just too much, you know, we encourage them, and we'd even facilitate, try to help them find another biblical church in Columbus. But with that being said, we love what we do. And again, I was actually talking to a buddy of mine who's not a Christian the other day. And, you know, Columbus is a pretty secular city. We've got, we sometimes call Columbus Little Portland, in the sense that it's, which I actually was just in Portland and I told a guy that and he laughed. He was like, wow, great to be the standard, you know? Columbus is a very secular city. There's a lot of antagonism towards theologically conservative or biblical forms of Christianity in the city. But I was talking to a buddy of mine who's a non-Christian, and he told me, he's like, you know, the thing that's the most fascinating about you guys, and he said, and in some ways, he's like, it's funny because churches offend people for all sorts of reasons, right? Mm-hmm. They offend them because they're political. They offend them because they've got a, you know, domineering leadership or something like that. And, you know, and there's good and bad reasons for the church to cause offense. And he was like, what's funny about you guys, he says, the most attractive, but also in some ways the most offensive thing about you at the same time is that you are true communitarians in a radically individualistic culture. And he's like, that is simultaneously the absolutely most attractive thing about you and also the most offensive.
That's so interesting.
Like, he was like, is everything about you disappoints my individualistic spirit, you know?
Yeah.
He's like, I can't engage with you as a consumer, and I can't engage with you, you know, in a way that's like, that's safe and programmatic. He's like, if I want to be involved, I have to get in the messiness of like real relationships and community and miscommunications and expectations and all the things that come with it. He's like, there's no like, you know, safe distance, you know, that I can approach you from. And he's like, and that's really offensive and difficult in some ways, but it's also at the same time really attractive because he's like, it's just not something I think that American culture produces. And so I actually thought that was a pretty profound insight.
And I took
it as a compliment too. I was like, I think that's actually a pretty good summary from the outside looking in of who we are.
Yeah. That's really interesting to hear someone who's not a Christian to articulate it in those words. It's like, okay. Yeah. I mean, it just carries a whole nother level of weight and significance, I feel. And so, I mean, you guys have been doing this since 1969. You have led many a house church, and you've multiplied those house churches many a times. And so I guess what I'm curious for us and for the listeners is just things that you've learned in the process of leading house churches and in journeying with house church leaders themselves. And so as you kind of survey, and some of this too, I mean, we'll get into this maybe a little bit later in the podcast, but some of this too, I'm thinking about you and your current stage of life. So Josh and his family and a team of people are getting ready to transition out of Orlando, out of Ohio to Orlando to plant a church. And so there's like that, like, I just think that's such an interesting position to be in, because you're kind of sitting in the in-between. Like, you haven't quite started what you're going to, but you're also coming out of this thing that you've been a part of for such a long time. And there's a way that you can kind of look back and reflect on that experience and say, these are some things that I've learned having done this. And so, I mean, we've already gotten to a handful of that, like talking about, you know, the need for maybe a broader structure to support house churches, the importance of plurality of leadership, and some of those other things that maybe you've learned in the process of doing house churches over time. But I'd be curious if there were like one or two other things, just like, man, like this, these are some of like the key things that we've learned about doing house churches or from journeying with microchurch leaders.
Yeah.
This is what we've learned.
Yeah. Those are good questions. Yeah, I am honestly in a pretty interesting space personally. Because my job ends in July. I'm leaving my network. You know, I love this church and I believe in the work that Dwell does. I love it, warts and all. And we're going out with the blessing of the church. But at the same time, we're going out with the blessing. But, and this again is, I think, something that I'm really grateful for about the tribe that I've been raised in, you know, so to speak, is that there's this high value for change and experimentation and doing things differently if necessary, contextualizing your ministry. And so what's cool is that, you know, we're going out with the blessing of Dwell, but we're going out to plant an authentically independent church. But yeah, I think things I've learned by journeying with house church leaders. You know, one thing that's really nice about Dwell is that we are, and I think Brian Sanders has like made fun of me for this the last time I was around him in a very friendly way, but he was like, you guys are the great producers of material. Like he's like, it's like your solution to all problems is to write a paper. And I'm like, that's kind of true. Like, that's like if we, like the body of literature that we've created over the course of 40, 50 years is kind of staggering. And again, it's actually one of those things that I think sometimes is confusing to people, because they'll find like some old version of a paper we wrote and we're like, wait, this is what you think? And we're like, no, that's actually like the eighth version of that. There's been eight more versions of that paper since then. We wrote that version in 1985 and now we're using this version, mm-hmm. you know, like whatever it might be, but they're all on our website for some reason, you know, like that kind of stuff. And so we have a lot of resources. And so in a lot of ways, I think like if you were to go to, you know, dwellcc.org and look through our pastoral papers, I mean, everything we've ever created pretty much is on our website. I think if you were to look through some of those papers, in a lot of ways, you would discover a lot of the corporate lessons that we've absorbed about leading house churches over time. Because a lot of what we've written over time has been to pastorally address the things that we've encountered, right? Mm-hmm. So like a good example of that would be, we have a paper on our website called Confidentiality and Conferral. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, one of the things about being a part of a house church movement is that, you know, there is a level of transparency in a community like that is biblical and important. But also like so many things that are good has an opposite edge that can be very bad. So, you know, transparency is great. Gossip is not. And people aren't always, you know, people don't always have the right kind of EQ to understand, you know, what's relevant and what's not relevant when sharing information and trying to help other people. Right. And so that's a natural mess in community that we can't be resolved by just writing a paper, but we did write a paper. to try to help people understand, like, okay, biblically, here's how we think about this. And so we've created, you know, resources to try to help people learn how to do that. And so I think one of the things that I've learned, so that's an example, but to extrapolate the principle from it, I'm a big believer, and I think this is true of everybody. This is true of you and me in our formal pastoral roles, but it's also true of lay leaders, and we ought to respect lay leaders enough to give them ongoing equipping and training. Right? Ongoing equipping and training. I believe the Holy Spirit picks people up and takes them off and does things with them. And I think some of the most beautiful things that we see in all of the church today are the things that are spontaneous and of the Holy Spirit, that, you know, that aren't programmatic, that aren't meddled with. But at the same time, I think where we have opportunity and availability, we ought to be like Paul and Apollos and those guys. And we ought to, you know, backtrack and go back and visit, you know, the churches in Asia Minor and do some teaching and some instructing. We ought to gather them up in the school of Tyrannus and give them what we can to develop and facilitate their work, you know? And so what I've found is that, people really want to be equipped and they respond really well to being equipped. And, I think as equippers, we have to recognize our limitations. You know, we can't, there's pieces of spiritual leadership that we can't teach it. You know, it's got to be caught. It's got to be developed through relationship with God, but there are things that we can teach. And so, we actually demonstrate respect for leaders and for Christian leaders in the environments, you know, the small and the large environments that God has appointed them in, when we offer them opportunities for development. Yeah. And I think that's a shortcoming of a lot of more diffuse networks, is they help create something, they let it go, and then they basically say, you know, check in if you need anything, you know?
Right.
And I do, on the one hand, I think that some element of that is appropriate and important for there to be real autonomy and leadership. But I also think that some basic level of accountability and ongoing equipping and encouragement are two things that network leaders can and should offer. And I think that house church networks benefit greatly when those things are in place.
Yeah. I mean, listening to you talk about even listening to you talk about the lay leaders, talking about the pastors, that the people that you have on staff are primarily responsible for the equipping and for building up of those lay leaders. I mean, you all invest so heavily in your leaders. Like, it's evident that, okay, if we want to see healthy house churches, it's almost like this is a really obscure reference. I don't know if you would even know this, but I remember growing up in California, we used to hear that good cheese comes from happy cows. Happy cows come from California.
I've never heard that.
Yeah, I think it's a California thing to make us feel good about ourselves. But it's like, yeah, if you want to see healthy house churches come from healthy leaders. And healthy leaders who are growing and all that, there needs to be people who are equipping and investing in them. And it sounds like you guys have really have taken that on and have done that really, really well. And so that's cool. I mean, I guess as you've seen that, and I mean, I think one of the interesting things about doing that is that as you go about journeying with leaders and coaching leaders, is that you then begin to pick up, it's one thing to coach one leader and like maybe one leader has a particular issue that they're trying to navigate and work their way around. But as you interact with more leaders, you have a bigger sense of, okay, actually this might be something that isn't just true of this house church, but maybe is applicable to maybe it's a big issue that a lot of house church leaders face. And now we're having to produce papers and navigate some of that, like transparency, confidentiality, all that. I guess I would want to know if there's anything that as you have coached leaders that's like, okay, this seems to be a big thing across house churches that I've coached. Like this is like the big barrier or the big question that they've been wrestling with. And these are maybe some of the thoughts that we have around that.
Well, you know, I think there's some things that I could tell you like more kind of immediate things, but I could also tell you just general, more big picture things. I think, Yeah, things that I feel like it never seems like there's not a need for teaching on these things would include development and help in improving the level of Bible teaching. Mm. I think that's a big one. We do a lot of work in teaching people homiletics, how to preach, how to lead, discussion oriented, you know, teachings we call them. So that's an ongoing need. It's partially an ongoing need because we're always training new teachers. Mm. You know, any house church. So any time that we've planted a house church, one of the first questions that I've asked the new team is, who are your next leaders? Mm. It's usually like the first or second question I ask, because who do you think the next leaders are in this group? And usually there's people that some of the leaders or other people have been discipling for years that are there that weren't maybe necessarily qualified yet to take point in leading a house church when this new house church was planted. But they're almost there. I mean, maybe they're discipling a person or two. Maybe they're serving in other ministries. They're growing in their character and their spirituality. And so, so a lot of times what we are always doing is then trying to provide resources, but then also coaching those leaders on how to coach their upcoming leaders, right? Mm-hmm. And develop them to do the things that they do, because that's the multiplication DNA. I mean, you know, this group can gather a crowd of people, but if there's not people to lead, if there's not men and women who are mature and ready to go, then that group is stuck. So, I think that's one thing that we're always, that's kind of two things. It's Bible teaching, but it's also checking in, asking productive questions, and helping them discern and identify who is God really raising up in this community.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And so I think that's never ending. I mean, that's always something that we're there doing. You know, one thing that's and this is maybe a cultural thing that's, I mean, I feel like, you know, if you listen to a million different podcasts or teachings around the country for Christian leaders, everyone's kind of talking about some version of this. But I tell you what, I mean, I've been coaching house churches since 2012. And something which we didn't have to do as much of between 2012 and say 2018, 2017, which we have to do a lot of now, is coaching leaders through extremely complicated pastoral situations. Mm. And it's not that, man, I mean, I don't know, man, I don't, it's not that like people didn't have problems before 2017.
Right.
But there's just some stuff that's been happening in our culture in the last, you know, 7 years. I mean, people are really angry and there's a lot of conflict and a lot of blaming and finger pointing and also the mental health crisis is so real. I think as we've absorbed a lot of, kind of later millennials and Gen Z up into our ministry, we're just encountering an unprecedented level of like of mental health issues, mm. which of course manifest themselves in a variety of ways, you know, and sometimes cause real problems in the context of a close community. And so I think helping leaders navigate those situations, like knowing when to refer someone to professional counseling versus trying to help them as a friend.
Right.
You know, those kinds of things. I mean, that's pretty sophisticated pastoral work. And so, that's something that I think I think that's something we have to put a lot of time into these days, which again is in many ways, I think it's probably a cultural thing. It's something that's happening in the society. It's the spirit of the age, you know, but it's been difficult. And I think that's something which a lot of our leaders are trying to figure out how to navigate. And we're trying to figure out how do we simultaneously help leaders, you know, like protect leaders and help them like discern, okay, don't wade too deep into that. Like, let's try to figure out other ways to help that person, like whatever it might be. But at the same time, embracing the messiness that is community. I mean, this is the mess we've chosen, right? You know, we, We are here to be the church to a hurting and lost generation of people, to welcome them into our homes. And people have a lot of problems, you know, and they bring those problems into the church. And so helping people find the spiritual resources for endurance, but then also the wisdom to know how to love and meet those people where they are at effectively, is tough, you know? And so I think that's something else that we find the need to do a lot of coaching and equipping on.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so interesting. And it's true. And what I think is maybe really fascinating too about your story is that, yeah, I mean, because you guys have been around for as long as you have, I mean, you guys have just seen waves. And I mean, I think when we've talked, I mean, there's maybe been three major church splits or seasons of this kind of like division or something. I don't know. I don't know if it was three, but there's been you've had some rough goes at it with dealing with angry people and all of that, and some of the maturity and wisdom that you guys have maybe grown in as a result of that, that like to even be able to speak to house churches about, you know, how to respond to some of that, I think is so cool. I mean, I want to respect your time, but I mean, I would just love to hear your perspective. Like, as you have dealt with some of these kind of more difficult, divisive seasons and anger and people and all that, I don't know. Yeah. What's been the learning point or the thing that you've like taken away from some of that? How have you guys moved through some of those seasons? That's a terrible question to like ask towards the end of a podcast. That's the beginning of a whole other podcast.
No, man, it's a good question though. I mean, yeah, I realized this just recently that I was talking to a guy who's a leader of a mega church on the West Coast, and he made this remark. He called Dwell an old church. And it sort of shocked me for a second, and it's been almost like an epiphany of the last, you know, 4 or 5 years for me, is realizing, because I think of us as more of like a movement, you know, like I was a part. I came here in 2006 to go to college at Ohio State. I gave my life to Christ, and I got involved in a house church, and I saw our campus young adult ministry go from 400 people to 2,000 people over the course of 9 years. 8 or 9 years, and just like this massive season of growth. And so I viewed myself as being a part of something new, you know? Mm-hmm. But you know, one of the things about being an old church, if you study the life cycle of a lot of large, evangelical, I mean, evangelical, like the old sense of that word, like not the new sense of that word. But, if you study the life cycle of a lot of large evangelical churches, they really don't last typically for more than a generation. Then they usually go through a division of some kind, or they kind of splinter, you know, and move out. And I think in a lot of ways, the pressures of being a large and older church is that you end up multiplying these institutional elements to create stability. And I think that in a lot of ways, you know, because every church that I've ever encountered that has seen, I mean, I've studied probably 20 churches over the country, all over the country. I've interfaced with their leaders. I've gone and studied them. I've spent time. I've interviewed their members. And I think any large church I've ever studied that had a meaningful impact, specifically on non-Christians in this country, and saw a lot of growth, has also suffered seasons of division and difficulty and lack from the culture and things like that. And I think and if you look at the New Testament, that was normative for them too. On a much higher level. And in a lot of ways, there's a lot of evidence here that our lampstand is still burning very bright. I mean, you know, we have sort of like a reporting system for just like kind of like a praise reporting system for just letting people know when someone's come to faith somewhere. Cause you know, we don't have large altar calls. Right. And so when someone comes to faith in Christ, it usually happens in a house church, and it might be on the other side of town, and maybe I've never met those people. And so we have sort of a reporting system for like, if someone does come to faith, we encourage people like, hey, let us know that someone came to faith in your house church, so that we can pray for them and celebrate it, you know? And so we, and I would say that we get those alerts daily, daily that people are coming to faith in house churches all over the city. And, so it's like, you know, our lampstand is burning bright. I mean, people are growing spiritually. We're seeing people's lives change, people coming to faith. And so I'm so confident that God is with this church and that he's got awesome plans for the future of the church. But it is a challenge to be an old church that's gone through, you know, like we had a big division in the 90s and lost a ton of people during that time. And we've kind of had with our leadership transition and rebranding and stuff, we had, you know, issues in the last 5 years. But what's really cool is that God has continued to work here throughout all of that, you know, and I don't think we've handled it all perfectly, but I also think that God has continued to show us both in overt and supernatural ways, but also in kind of small and in more personal ways that he is with us, that he is working, the Holy Spirit is just alive and well here in this church. And so please pray that lampstand continues to burn bright. But then also pray that we can continue to adapt and grow. I hope in 20, 30 years, I hope that we'll still be seeing hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of people come to Christ through the network of house churches here. And that in many ways, the core elements of Dwell will be the same, but that we'll navigate the changing cultural moment in the way that we should. And so... But I think what's cool though, in looking back at our history, is that we've done that before, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think that, again, I wasn't here in the 90s, but when there was a massive division and 1,000 people left the church, right? You know, we humbled ourselves, we developed, we grew, and God continued to work here. And I think that there is a lot of perseverance that's necessary for anyone that wants to do. I mean, if anyone who wants to do ministry in general and serve God in general, perseverance is needed. We know that from Scripture, but there is a certain kind of perseverance that's needed to keep working with people up close and personal in this way.
Yeah.
And to do it at a large scale. And so yeah, please pray for unity for us and for a proper theology of change. But also, please praise God that, you know, for all the evidence that he's still with us and working through us in ways that are mighty.
That's incredible, man. And you, my friend, you figured out a way to take a bad last question and give a good final answer. You are a gentleman and a scholar. Josh, thank you so much for hopping on this podcast with me. It always feels like these conversations are just beginning. Whenever we kind of wrap up at the end, it's just the nature of talking to somebody who has such experience and wisdom, and you just want to soak it all up. So thank you so much for taking time with me. Guys, this has been Micro Churches. If you haven't checked out Dwell, you can go ahead and go to dwellcc.org.
Yep, that's right.
And learn about them. Josh is fantastic. You can get connected with him before he transitions into his new role. Is there any other links that they should be aware of? Do you guys have a podcast? Anything like?
We have a podcast. Yeah, we have a podcast called Dwell on These Things. You can search that. But yeah, I mean, our website's good. Our website's actually pretty good. We redid it recently, and you can find most resources through that. If you just go, yeah, www.dwellcc, because Dwell Community Church is our full name, .org, then you'd be able to navigate pretty much all of our resources through that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, man. And we'll definitely be praying for you and your community and your family as you transition.
Thanks, brother.
For those of you guys who are listening, thank you so much. This has been Micro Churches. Until next time.